Hitchhiking used to be the great American pastime. You know, wholesome, like baseball, only cheaper and faster. Everybody did it, men, women, young, old, rich. Okay, maybe not the rich. But the thing is, people did it for adventure, not just because they couldn't cough up bus fare. Today, everything's changed. Hitchhiking is now thought of as the cheap, fast version of Russian roulette, suitable only for serial killers, perverts, and werewolves. That nice young lady with her thumb out by the interstate? Probably Charlize Theron in Monster. Welcome to Hearing Voices from NPR. I'm Larry Massett, our show today. Thumb and Thumber, The Joys of Hitchhiking. Producer Jonathan Mitchell says it's time for us to rethink the whole business. Forget the metaphors. Hitchhiking's not baseball, it's not roulette, it's just what it is. That's all. Here's how he does it.
It's 10:52 in the morning. I'm hitchhiking on the side of the road in Vallejo, California. In Vallejo, California. I'm holding a sign that says Oakland. I'm sticking out my thumb. And I'm completely stranded at this point. Because I hitchhiked here. I got here.
People expect a hitchhiker to be someone who is either mentally unbalanced or looking for a handout.
It's free.
Whereas, in truth, many of us just want a ride and great conversation and to learn a little something more.
New places, new people, amazing things you learn.
You never know who you're going to meet.
You don't know who you're going to meet next.
You just don't know who you're getting in the car with.
Totally anonymous, totally free.
As a peace officer telling my son or daughter of the dangers, I could just share some of the stories that I've heard from other officers.
Just a complete random number.
Sexual assaults.
There's a zillion cool people out there.
Physical assaults.
It's nothing like people have been led to believe by all the doom and gloom on the news reports.
And robberies that take place. It's just not a good idea. We just strongly encourage folks to use transportation, buses.
I wish more people would hitchhike. I wish everybody would lose the fear mentality.
You don't have to take every ride that you're offered. I mean, if you get a bad feeling about taking a ride, you don't take it. If you're in a car and somebody starts creeping out, you ask them to stop and you get out. And then you stick out your thumb and somebody else will stop. Yeah.
There's a car that just stopped on the side of the road, but... Are you going to Oakland?
No,
I'll catch a bus. Oh, no, that's okay. No, I don't need it. I got money. I got money. That woman just tried to offer me $20 to take the bus. That's so funny.
It's a dangerous, deadly business, being on the side of the highway.
They've got to have time to see you, plenty of room to pull over.
It's illegal to hitchhike on the side of a freeway. Now, when you're standing on a highway, it's illegal to stand on a roadway. Where you'd want to stand is on the shoulder portion of the road, right adjacent to the pavement with your thumb out.
I've stood in places for hours occasionally, and I have more times than I can count also been picked up by the very first car. But roughly 15 minutes, you ought to be moving, which is not long.
It's 11:09 now. Still no ride. It's been 17 minutes. Are you going to Oakland?
Alameda.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, I'm going to go.
My name is Jonathan.
I'm Herb.
Nice to meet you.
Okay, get yourself seatbelted in.
Yes.
Why are you recording?
I'm doing a piece. I'm reading a piece about hitchhiking.
Oh, and I'm did a lot of hitchhiking.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. We can talk about it.
Yeah, well, I hitchhiked in Europe and I hitchhiked in America. Uh-huh. America's got better hitchhiking than Europe.
Why? Why is
more
that?
Cars. Many, many, many more cars.
You just immediately jump right into talking.
In 1971, I decided I was going to take a vacation from everything mechanical, so I hitchhiked.
You talk story with people, whatever they feel like talking about, you just talk along with them.
You're meeting someone who has completely different ideology than you. I mean, in some cases, they may be someone you would never normally associate with in day-to-day life.
Now, I gave you a ride because I hitchhiked a lot in my youth.
Uh-huh. Right. It seems like people hitchhike less nowadays, you know, because people are kind of more afraid than they used to be of one another. And
that may be the case.
I mean, have you ever felt like you were subject to danger when you were hitchhiking?
No. The worst problem for the hitchhiker is getting stranded. I know one woman who was hitchhiking and was raped.
Really?
And the person who raped her didn't threaten her with a gun. He threatened to strand her.
Men prey on women oftentimes. That's not to say they're not going to prey on a young man as well.
I had one guy proposition me, but he propositioned me and he took an overt answer. It took me where I was going.
Right. Yeah.
You always get there. From Cocoa Beach to San Diego, ride number 7 out of 7 happened from the deserts west of Fort Worth, Texas. And this particular gentleman had a car full of other people that he'd picked up hitchhiking. And he was on the Lam from Leavenworth, and he had his, quote, residence, unquote, card from Leavenworth. I don't know how he got out. He didn't volunteer, and I wasn't digging too much. This guy was an escapee, and he had the car full of hitchhikers so that the car never stopped. When he would sleep, there'd be one of us driving. He trusted us to do that, and he wound up taking me directly to the doorstep of the house I was going to on Cape May Avenue in Ocean Beach in San Diego. Way out of his way. He was heading up to Northern California. Fascinating character. People are cool. Or at least the nice ones are. And the mean ones don't give you rides. So it's just basically a cool way to meet new and fascinating people.
If you hitchhike, who you're going to meet? You're going to meet the guys who aren't afraid of you.
I mean, yeah, things can go wrong, but...
For some of us, it's worth the risk.
Because I choose not to live in fear.
I mean, I've been on stretches of highway that just moments of just brilliant epiphany, of just feeling like right there at that moment is the only place on earth I want to be.
I can pull over here, can't I?
All right, cool. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yeah, it was nice talking to you.
My name is Herb.
My name is Jonathan.
And
have a safe trip to
Alameda.
Yes. Great. Cool. Okay, take care.
Okay.
A Beginner's Guide to Hitchhiking, produced by Jonathan Mitchell. Go. This music is from the group Lemon Jelly. The voice, incredibly, is the voice of William Shatner. I'm not altogether sure what he's saying or why, but he's William Shatner. You're listening to Thumb and Thumber, The Joys of Hitchhiking on Hearing Voices. The best part of hitchhiking is the unexpected adventure. Some are good adventures, others bad, and a lot of them are just really, really dumb. Producer Scott Carrier has been through a lot of hitchhiking dumbness over the years. Here is one of his favorite stories.
This is a long story about nothing in the end except dumb luck. Sometimes luck comes in a deserving fashion to the righteous. Sometimes it comes without justice to the wicked. And still other times it simply falls upon the dumb, like manna from heaven. This is what happened. I've been in India, working as a sound engineer on a radio documentary series. By day, we interviewed some of the poorest people in the world. By night, we slept in the most expensive hotels in town. At that time, almost 16 years ago, this made me feel guilty and somehow responsible for the plight of the downtrodden masses. But now, it wouldn't bother me. In fact, I might insist upon it, as I've learned that a good night's sleep is essential to a good day's work. And then dropping a lot of money at an expensive hotel probably does more for the poor than spending only a few bucks at a dive. The producer was a large man, prone to sweating profusely, and he had the annoying habit of always asking whomever we interviewed if they could sing. We'd be talking to, say, some women whose husbands had drunk themselves to death at an early age on wood alcohol. And after the husbands were gone, the wives would be left in the house of their father-in-law, who sooner or later would decide to pour gasoline on the woman and light her on fire. And they'd have burns all over their bodies and be living on the streets. They'd tell us their stories, and then the producer would say, "Yes, that's very sad, but could you sing a song for us?" And they'd sing, nearly every time. I hated that, but now I understand the tactic. If there's one thing that cuts through the problem of awkward translations on the radio, it's a song sung by a woman who was nearly burned alive. There were other disappointments. One involving a trip almost 1,000 miles to interview the Dalai Lama, only to find out he wasn't home. But most troubling of all were the financial problems. When all was said and done, I ended up at JFK in New York with a 4-inch-high stack of rupees worth about 30 cents on the dollar. All told, it came to around $100, and I still needed to get home to Salt Lake City. First, I went to Macy's on Broadway and bought a new pair of shoes for $60. White basketball shoes, high top, really good ones. I felt good about this because I wanted more than anything to get out of the shoes I'd worn in India. Not because they hurt my feet or because they were worn out, but because I was back in the United States, where big, fat men laughed as they made my pizza and taunted me when I couldn't decide what to put on it. I wanted to have shoes like that, not shoes that had walked through the land of empty stomachs. I rolled up my pants to my shins and walked out on Broadway feeling good every time my soles hit the street. Then I spent another $5 on a bus ticket across the river to New Jersey, where I walked a short distance to Interstate 80. I had only $35 in my pocket, but that didn't seem like a problem then. I could hitchhike 1,000 miles a day. I could hitchhike faster than I could drive myself. Now, I dislike hitchhiking. I quickly got a ride. The car was a Dodge Dart, maybe a 74, with a shiny new coat of gold paint. Inside were two young men, maybe 20 years old, both with long hair and bomber jackets. They were what we used to call hoods, low-level criminals, gruff in their speech and simple in their motivation, summed up by the phrase, "Party on, dude." They were on their way to work in a shoe factory and were preparing for their shift by drinking beer and smoking a joint. I told them that I just bought a new pair of shoes and lifted one leg from the back seat to show them, explaining that I'd just gotten back from India and how they should be very careful about ever wanting to go there. But they were really completely uninterested in this. The driver said, "Have a beer, dude, and mellow out. Here, you get high?" I'm pretty sure that joint was laced with PCP, because one hit and I became extremely nervous, my hands shaking, my whole body convulsing in tremors. This I could handle, but then they stuck in an 8-track of Metallica. I'd never heard of Metallica. They were kind of new back then, and to me it sounded like a terrible monster that eats strip malls, teeth grinding concrete overpasses, Godzilla music, truly frightening. So I took out my tape recorder and preserved it for posterity. We were tooling along at 80 miles an hour on a 55 mile an hour freeway, eager, I guess, to get to work at the shoe factory, when the driver suddenly yelled,
"Yo, dude! Yo, dude! Yo, dude! Cap that beer! There's a cop behind us!
The beer's gone!
Oh, it's just...
I didn't turn around. I didn't need to turn around. I tried to hide the empty bottles under my hat, but there were too many of them, so I pushed them up under the front seat.
He's gonna look.
The patrolman was young, just a kid, also about 20 years old. He politely asked for the registration, and the driver said he didn't have one. So the cop asked for his driver's license and went back to the patrol car. Then he came back and asked the driver to spell his last name as it was written on the license. The driver spelled it, and the cop said, "That's close, but that's not correct. Everybody step out of the car." Searching the car, the cop found the beer bottles and lined them up along the back seat. Then he found the roach and set it right in the middle of the front seat. Then he told us to get back inside the car and not touch anything. He went back to his cruiser and called in support, while we sat there next to the evidence, like a living museum exhibit of the drug culture. Another patrolman arrived, and we were taken out of the car one at a time and questioned. I told the officers the truth, that I was hitchhiking and I'd just met these fellows, my voice stuttering and tight, high-pitched, uncontrollable. One of them asked me what I did for a living, and I told him that I was a radio producer, that I'd just been in India and was on my way home. He asked if I had any professional identification, and I told him I was an independent producer, which meant that I was pretty much self-employed. But then I remembered that I did have something to prove my story. It was a telegram that had been sent to me in India by a producer at National Public Radio, whom I'll call Mr. X. I'd ask him to send it as a letter of introduction, just in case I happened to run into the Dalai Lama. The telegram was only a couple of weeks old, but the thing looked like it had been through a war. The words were printed on a thin strip of paper, like ticker tape, and then cut every 7 inches and pasted onto another piece of paper, one line below the other. It read as follows. "To whom it may concern, Mr. Scott Carrier is a freelance journalist working for our organization as a radio reporter. Please accord him access to documents, interviews, musical events, public speeches and ceremonies, entertainments, and religious festivals, with full knowledge that he is a working journalist on assignment. Signed, your obedient servant, Mr. X." I told the cops it was a telegram for the Dalai Lama, and they asked me who that was. I said, "The 14th Dalai Lama is the reincarnation of Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion." And they looked at me like I might be pulling their legs. "Really," I said, "he's one of the most important people in the world." They read the thing and turned the page over and tried to pull the strips off the page to see if it was real. But who would make up a thing like that? They told us to get back in the car, and then they went and sat in their car and talked about it for about 20 minutes. And then the first cop came up to the window with a speeding ticket for 72 miles an hour and told us to be on our way. He let us go.
Plead guilty or not guilty? Right, what am I on, talk radio or what? Huh? TLJ or what?
I don't know this guy.
All right.
I can mail it in, right?
Yeah, you can.
Okay, great.
Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, thanks a lot, man.
We drove down the highway very carefully and then pulled off at the exit to the shoe factory. I got out and said so long, and they never once said thanks or, hey, dude, bitchin' telegram. I'm still a little upset about that, because even thick-necked hoods should give credit where credit is due.
Hey, stay warm, buddy.
Thanks a lot. Hey, lucky guy.
So there I was, at dusk in early December, standing at an off-ramp in New Jersey or Pennsylvania, surrounded by a thick forest. I was still shaking, but I was in America, land of the free and home of the brave.
Coming up, we pick up every hitchhiker between New Mexico and Florida when we continue with Thumb and Thumber on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Thumb and Thumber, the joys of hitchhiking on Hearing Voices.
This backpack you see here, that's my home. Okay? What kind of life is that? I'm doing what I want. Nothing holds me. I can go from here to Interstate 270. You stand there and stick out my thumb and catch a ride. I might have 10 cars go by me. Maybe 50 cars will go by me before I get one ride. But I never know. It's a chance I take. I like to choose my own destiny.
One day, in the summer of 1980-something, Scott Carrier and I bought a used car in Santa Fe, New Mexico. By used, I mean the engine sounded like a bucket of nails, and the paint was flaking off, and so was the chrome, and so were the tires. But it was an Olds 88, a whale among cars, one of the longest road boats ever made in America. We decided to sail the thing south as far as it would go, stopping for every hitchhiker we came across, talking to every trucker and every truck stop, pausing in every town park to chat with whoever was hanging out on the park benches. Somehow, we made it all the way to Key West, Florida. Here's how it went.
Truck drivers are the last of the American cowboys. There's no doubt about it. I mean, most all of them, I did my time on ranches, roping cows, and putting fences, throwing hay, you know, all the old stuff. Whether it's just the drifter and people or what, I don't know. I like to travel. It's not like going in, punching the time clock, going and doing the same job for 25 years. I don't know how people do that. I couldn't do it. Just no way. I feel good when I'm on the road. And most truckers that I've run into are pretty much loners. You know, you have a tendency to be that way. And you get up in your truck and nobody bothers you and you can drive and do your business and you don't have a boss standing over your shoulder telling you what to do. You might have a dispatcher on the phone, but you can always hang up and tell him to go to hell, you know, and it doesn't matter. And while you're driving, you can, you know, reflect back on things that happened to you and, you know, look forward to different things because every day is something different. You never know what's going to happen. You know? And that's what's nice about it.
So many people. You're always on the move. You're always meeting people. You're always in a new town. You get burned out in one place and you head down the road to the next community and you live there for a few weeks or whatever and then you get burned out and head on down the road to the next community, so on and so forth. And always a new experience for you. You never get, you know, become a robot. I've been rebellious ever since I was a small child and
12, 13 years old, I've been rebellious. I started running away from home and traveling the country when I was 12 years old. And I did my first major trip from coast to coast when I was 12 years old. And that trip took me about 4 months, and I did all my own. And at the time, I was parents had the law looking for me, and everybody was hunting for me, and they all thought I was dead and all this good stuff. But I was just out living my life the way I figured it should be lived. I'm a total outlaw in every shape of the word. I do narcotics. I like to smoke pot. I like to drink. I like to party. I don't like to have a house and a mortgage and car payments and three kids and wife. I'm not interested in none of that. I'm out here to make my life better because I was put here to have a good time. I wasn't put here for anybody else's pleasure but my own.
Christ is on earth today, and he's reigning as king of the earth. I know this to be a fact because I seen him about, well, it was 1978 in June, and I was on my way to college. I was going to take a test to go into college at Las Cruces, and on the way to college, it was at night, about 2 a.m. in the morning, and I seen this glow up in front of me, and then I seen Jesus. His glory had a light that shone about 300 feet around him, in the front of him and to his sides.
He was on the highway?
Yeah, he was on the side of the highway, and he had his arms outstretched, both fists closed. He was pretty close to the pictures in the Holy Bible, in the King James Version, and the love that Jesus had in his eyes for me was unbewildering, you know. I mean, I could just look at his eyes and I could tell that he had so much love for mankind that he's came back now to reign as king on the earth.
Where is he? Where is he now?
He lives in the Oregon Mountains.
Really?
Really. Jesus comes down out of the Oregon Mountains and stands by the roadside late at night and watches for people that have come to know him. All of the heads of the churches were out to get Jesus. He was introducing a new form of religion, and the old priests couldn't handle it because they had their own bureaucracies that they'd written themselves. And they can't nail him to a cross anymore though, because he's too big now.
How big is he?
He's 80 foot tall. These trucks are his roller skates.
I would say probably the best time I ever had is I was hitchhiking in California, and I was flat broke and I had no money. And I had no prospects to get any money. Hadn't eaten for a couple of days. And I was standing out on the side of the road, and it was about 80 degrees, and I was sweating to death. And I thought I was very uncomfortable at that point. And this guy pulled up in a Jeep and picked me up and took me to his house. And turns out he's a millionaire, and he lives in Bel Air in California. So I go to his house, and he puts me up for like 4 months. And I don't pay anything. I don't pay for food. I don't pay for any lodging. I don't pay for anything. We just sit around and drink beer all day. And at the end of the day, we'd go and sit on the beach. He lived right on the ocean. We walked down this hill from Dana Point, and we walked down into the ocean, and we just party out. It was just like I was a little kid again. I had absolutely no responsibilities to anybody. I didn't have to give anybody any money. I didn't have to worry about supporting myself or anything. It was all there. It was all given to me.
Pick up dogs and cats and stray people. I try to help them out until they prove themselves otherwise. I treat them like a gentleman, see. But I have seen many, many young people come down here flat broke, and I've stuck my hand in my pocket and give them like a couple of days eating or something like that. In the old days, we could leave our homes wide open and go out, and everybody liked one another. We went to dances and we all knew everybody. There was no strangers in our midst. But now we feel so many people, new people here, that we have to watch them as they come up and watch them as they go by. In other words, you're suspicious of them. Who are they? Don't know who you're going to talk to nowadays. But in the old days, it was altogether different. Everybody knew everybody. We more or less married my friend's daughter. My friend's daughter would marry my son or something like that, you see. The quality of life here is eroding because we're shying away from each other. We're scared of each other.
Take me up there one time. We got out in the country about 5 miles, old car run hot. He got out, sprayed the hood. And I got out, walked around there, and this one fella, he hit and knocked me about 10 feet up shoulder of the road. Got out there and stomped me, and left me there and took my money. He was driving an old Plymouth car. Highway patrol come by and found me. That's the rottenest bunch I ever run upon.
Do they seem friendly and everything when they took you off?
Not particular. They didn't act overly friendly. Woman never did get out of the car. But they busted my suitcase and took $82, $82 money off me. That's some rotten people.
Like, I have a cook that makes my pies.
I've been a musician, I play the club, but
we don't serve anything that is pre-cooked. Everything we eat is made fresh.
We're self-busted about all night, about 32 years.
I've got a cousin 3 months younger than me. He was in Northeast Texas. He was in the Marines. He came out of the Marines in 42, I think it was. Come out here, and I got him a job firing on the railroad. He worked 30 days and told him to shove it. Went back down Northeast Texas, and he's never worked with nobody since. All he's done is sell menace. Menace? Little tiny fishes you fish with. Okay? He hasn't made enough money. I bet you that you could buy everything he's got for $500. But he's just as happy as a bird in a gilded cage, see? His wife's happy, he's raised a family, and they're all happy. Well, if that's what you want, well, that's success. Now me, I wouldn't be satisfied with that. Not by a whole lot. And I got a good pension. I got my home paid for, my car paid for, my truck paid for. I got 3 notes on houses in El Paso, and they're paying me. I'm not rich, but I'm not hurting. In other words, if I want to go to China, I'll go to China. I want to stay next door.
She settled down. She's married to a Texan. I don't like him at all. I don't like him at all. We don't get along at all. He kicked me out of. I went to see it when I went down there. I was promised a place to live until I got my own place. And I went down there and he kicked me out. I said, "Hey, I don't need you." I told him. I said, "I don't need you and nobody else. I can make it on my own." I slept on this here campground for a long time. But I succeeded, you know. And I got food in my gut. I worked my butt off and stuff. And I made it.
You're listening to Thumb and Thumber, The Joys of Hitchhiking, on Hearing Voices. We're about halfway to Florida in the Olds 88 now. We're going to make a pit stop for a minute so we can hear an old song about hitchhiking.
I was out on the West Coast trying to make a buck, and things didn't work out. I was down on my luck. Got tired of roaming and bumming around, so I started thumbing back east toward my hometown. Made a lot of miles the first 2 days, and I figured I'd be home in a week if my luck held out this way. But the third night I got stranded way out of town at a cold, lonely crossroads. Rain was pouring down. I was hungry and freezing, done caught a chill, when the lights of a big semi topped the hill. Lord, I sure was glad to hear them air brakes come on. And I climbed in that cab where I knew it'd be warm. At the wheel sat a big man. He weighed about 210. He stuck out his hand and said with a grin, "Big Joe's the name." I told him mine. And he said the name of my rig is Phantom 309. Well, I asked him why he called his rig such a name. He said, "Son, this old Mac can put them all to shame. There ain't a driver or a rig a running any line that's seen nothing but taillights from Phantom 309. Well, we rode and talked the better part of the night when the lights of a truck stop came in sight. He said, "I'm sorry, son, this is as far as you go, 'cause I gotta make a turn just on up the road." Well, he tossed me a dime as he pulled her in low and said, "Have yourself a hot cup on old Big Joe." When Joe and his rig roared out in the night, in nothing flat he was clean out of sight. Well, I went inside and ordered me a cup, told the waiter Big Joe was setting me up. Oh, you could have heard a pin drop. It got deathly quiet, and the waiter's face turned kind of white. "Well, did I say something wrong?" I said with a halfway grin. He said, "No, this happens every now and then. Every driver in here knows Big Joe. But son, let me tell you what happened about 10 years ago. At the crossroads tonight where you flagged him down, there was a busload of kids coming from town. And they were right in the middle when Big Joe topped the hill. It could have been slaughter, but he turned his wheels. Well, Joe lost control, went into a skid, and gave his life to save that bunch of kids. And there at that crossroads was the end of a line for Big Joe and Phantom 309. But every now and then, some hiker will come by, and like you, Big Joe will give him a ride. Here, have another cup, and forget about the dime. Keep it as a souvenir from Big Joe and Phantom 309.
Phantom 309, written by Tommy Fail, sung by Red Savine. Now, back on the road.
It wasn't me that done anything. My father was gone away, and my uncle, he had supposed to have accidentally murdered my mother, which I've never seen in my life. He was supposed to have decapitated her head, and her body had, when they found her, had cuts all over it and slices and deep indentations, and was buried up by a dried up riverbed, halfway dried up. But when I say I haven't seen my mother, I'm not old enough to remember her. I get sights and visions, and I seen a picture of her one time. After that, I was put in something to do with the courts, legal custody. The courts had control of me, and they put me in foster homes here and there, and things like that. And foster homes ain't all what they're cracked up to be either. So, I ran away. The time I ran away, I was 15. Excuse me. And, I ended up in San Diego. It's the weather from being on the street, believe me. At 15, your knowledge is very minimal, especially about the scene that I had to go through and the things that I had to deal with. I was offered money for sexual favors, for sexual ordeals, and I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't do it. Finally, I got hungry and hungry and hungrier. I did it. I become a person that lives out here on benches, that has an intelligent mind, that does not belong in the surrounding atmosphere that I'm dealt with. What I mean by that is people sleeping in parks, literally covering themselves up with sand to keep warm on the beach, crawling in bushes. Like myself, last night, I was very fortunate. I found myself a whole blanket. And I felt very, very happy finding that blanket. Because I was cold. I was cold. I wouldn't have been if I had a job. I wouldn't have been if I had a job. I don't like living on the beach. Oh no. Oh no, 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 no. Everybody could use a chance.
What about the Army? Didn't you learn anything in the Army?
Oh yeah, I learned something in the Army.
What?
I'm the best damn tank driver you're ever gonna meet.
Street theater, come on, street theater. It's just the oldest form of theater there is. All theaters started on the street. It seems like in the last 50 or 60 years or so, somehow America lost touch with street theater. Since the streets are going mostly to the cars now, as it used to be, where all the politics, all the art, all the theater, everything was all out in the street.
What do you do?
Well, I do rope walking, juggling, some magic, some fire effects, fire manipulation. I walk on broken glass. I do rope escapes. It's just a matter of relaxing. Knowing in your head you can do it. Once you know you can do it, then you can do it. You can dream it, you can do it. I had that old green truck sitting over there with the windsurfer on top, and that's it. That's my home for 7 months of the year. I go around the United States and Canada and see what happens.
What am I doing? I'm just expressing the spirit of America. You know, I'm the what you might call the voice of America, the Love It or Leave It clan. I'm wearing a striped red and white alternating slacks, 100% cotton, made in America. And I'm wearing roller skates, which were also a product of this fine country. Red, white, and blue, right to the bones. You know, it's wake up America time. I've given my life to this country, but basically I'm selling pants, and I'd like to sell 1 million pair, you know, red and white stripes. I'd like to see everyone in America wearing red and white stripes to express the old glory that we've come so close to knowing. I'm presently involved with people that that have access to video equipment, and I'm hoping to get this message on tape and perhaps on the TV. National TV would be just great, and then I'll find out where America really is. You know, I'd like to see everyone in America wearing the striped pants.
You know who you are, what you are, and understand the things around you, then you're able to endure things that you couldn't endure otherwise. See, even throughout last winter and a half in New York City, I walked around in nothing but shorts, no short sleeve or no shirt at all.
Even in the winter. How did you do that?
Well, an elevated state of consciousness brings forth elevated durability. So that's the best answer I can give you. I was a Baptist minister some 9-8 years ago. Jesus said, "Go ye into all the world, observe all things, and don't judge them." All right? Then once we learn this, then we have no need to be in subject to another creature outside of ourselves.
You don't think that the U.S. government has any real power or real authority over you?
It doesn't. I'm under observation by FBI, and I'm aware of it. They won't touch me until I finish my work on Earth.
And then what will they do?
Well, I don't know if it'll be them or someone else, but they'll shoot me.
I am Sister Ivy. I don't know how to read one letter in English or any other language, but I could read your palm, and I read your vibrations. You'll be thinking of something, and I'll tell you what you're thinking of. I speak of past, present, and future. All of our future is in our own hands. The Lord and the God Almighty have given us our life to live. That's everybody. We live it whichever way we choose. You could be a drunkard. You could be a businessman. You could be an honest man. Or you could be a thief. And our life is in our own hands to do what we want with it. All right? And I wish good luck on you. And I wish good luck for the world, for everybody on Earth. And my prices is not very much.
Unfortunately, the gypsy did not warn us that our car, the beloved Olds 88, was about to blow a gasket. Either she didn't know or we didn't pay her enough. In memoriam, here's Ike Turner and the Kings of Rhythm singing the praises of Oldsmobile's Rocket 88 engine.
Women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along. Smart and designed, black convertible top, and the gals don't mind. Sporting with me, riding all around town for joy. Blow your horn, Raymond, blow!
The The Road was produced by myself, Larry Massett, and Scott Carrier. The studio engineer was Barrett Golding. This is HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darham. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.